WIOX is supported by the following community underwriters. WIOX is supported by Sam's and Fleischmann's, Sam's Country Store Deli and Gas Station, open every day for groceries, Mexican herbs, local craft beer, and with food to go, sandwiches, tortas, and tacos, and tamales on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Sam's on Main Street in Fleischmann's. SamsCountryStoreNY.com. Kriya, a store designed as a source for sustainable artisanal products, including Kriya's own jewelry made from reclaimed metals and ethically produced goods to wear and share. Kriya, K-R-I-A, on Main Street in Margaretville. More information at KriyaJewelry.com. Sweet Pea Supply Company, a general store stocking locally sourced products in the charming hamlet of Halkettsville. Freshly made baked goods and prepared dishes to take away. Daily lunch, dinner, and dessert specials. Posted on Facebook and Instagram. Open 10 to 6, Thursday through Monday. Sweet Pea Supply Company, Bragg Hollow Road in Halkettsville. 607-326-6776. 607-326-6776. SweetPeaSupplyCo.com. Hannah Mountain Resort and Country Club, with 29 guest rooms, restaurant, and bar, specializing in wedding packages, including rehearsal dinner, ceremony, reception, farewell brunch, and accommodations for guests. And golf memberships are available for Hannah's 18-hole championship golf course. Information at HannahCountryResort.com or 845-586-4849.
Hi, I'm Nathaniel Hitchcock, host of Liberal Arts Audio, where we host interviews with artists, curators, designers, and filmmakers, music and sound art. Alternate Tuesday afternoon from 1 to 2 p.m. right here on WIOX Roxbury Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM, MTC Cable Channel 20, and WIOXradio.org.
You're listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM, MTC Cable TV Channel 20 on the campus of SUNY Delhi at 107.5 FM, worldwide at WIOXradio.org, and on any mobile device FM radio app. This is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and Zane. Zane, how's it going?
Good, Ryan. How are you doing?
How am I doing? I'm doing all right. I tapped trees, maple trees, last week, and they started out slow, but I'm sure when I get home tonight, I'm expecting some sap.
So you're in red alert.
Yeah. But, you know, it was warm today.
It was very warm today.
Yeah. What was it, high 50s?
Yeah. It was definitely a day that tricked you that winter might be over, but... think it was just a fluke. We're going to see those temperatures drop throughout the rest of this week.
Yeah. Nothing crazy, though. Highs are up in the 30s, 40s, but there's a couple days in there where we're going to be cold, right? Highs in the 20s, lows in single digits or less.
Going back down.
Yeah. It's all right, you know? It's what we got wood for, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. So, anyway, tonight's topic is a repeat. Because the show was lost, we have to redo it because it's an important show. So tonight is going to be, again, about Smokey the Bear, climate change, and projected maple decline.
To revisit it.
Yeah, it's two messages.
It's doubly important.
Doubly important. Yeah, I like that. Nice. It's two messages, right? One's from the 40s. You know, only you can prevent forest fires. And I feel like that message has been worn out pretty good. And we'll talk about why. Just our opinions. Or my opinion, I don't know. We'll see and what Zane thinks.
And our observations as well.
Yeah, observations. As foresters, as forest ecologists, and people who work outside in the woods every day. And the second is about climate change and projected maple decline. And this is something that when we're not on the air here and we're at the Catskill Forest Association, we hear from our members that, you know, should I be planting southern trees? We're going to go into why you should do that or not do that. But the first one is message number one. Only you can prevent forest fires.
Yeah, I've heard that somewhere.
You've heard that, huh? Yeah. And the mascot for this is for this war is Smokey Bear. Born in 1944, right? It's a good time in America. Back-to-back World War champs, right? Yeah. Back-to-back World War champs. Isn't that awesome to say? Yeah, good time. And you corrected me last time. I think it was 1945 is VJ, right? 1944 is victory in Europe, right?
Yeah. My history is correct. August of 1945 is when everything ended.
Nice. Yeah, it was a glorious time. And America's warplanes, ships, and men would be called back home. And some of these would be used domestically to fight another war, not nearly as dramatic, but against fire. And we had University of Arizona's Stephen Pine, who wrote an awesome book, read it a number of years ago, called World Fire, The Importance and Significance of Fire. He also talks about, it may not be in World Fire, but he wrote another book just on fire in America. In fact, that might even be the title of it. And he talks about this surplus military gear being used to fight fire like they're fighting an enemy, you know, using planes, dumping stuff on them, fire lines, just attacking it like they're fighting the enemy.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of what we see on the nightly news about fighting wildfires out west, all those water bombs and the chemical bombs dumped on trees and forests, a lot of those were in the experimental stages back then.
Yeah. The U.S., let's see, according to Wikipedia, Smokey Bear, getting back to him, is an American campaign and advertising icon of the U.S. Forest Service in the Wildfire Prevention Campaign, which is the longest-running public service announcement campaign in the U.S. history, the Ad Council, the U.S. Forest Service, and the National Association of State Foresters, in partnership with creative agency FCB, employed Smokey Bear to educate the public about the dangers of unplanned human-caused wildfire. So preceding Smokey Bear, they were using Bambi and his cohort of woodland friends to, you know, fight against fire, maybe hunting too. But they didn't own him. Disney did. So they came up with their own 1944 Smokey the Bear. And there you have it.
Yeah, I mean, it was. He's definitely persisted in the culture for a very long time. But, you know, it was at the cost of kind of a more nuanced understanding of the forest and the public at that time. Unfortunately, I think a lot of what Smokey conveyed was the fact that all forest fires are bad. I mean, a lot of forests were seen as kind of tragedies in our forests because people just didn't associate that as being part of the ecology.
Totally. So, I mean, it goes further. there's a policy called the 10 a.m. policy, lights out by 10 a.m. And this precedes smoke. He was in the 1930s. And capitalizing on the Great Depression's overabundance of cheap labor, over 250,000 young men were tasked with building fire lines, towers, and roads. So in 1935, the chief forester of the Forest Service, Gus Silcox, used this army to realize the 10 a.m. policy. So what was this policy? It demanded that all wildfires, regardless of how remote, be brought under control by 10 a.m. the morning following ignition. That's pretty ambitious.
They met it. I mean, they were very effective. I mean, they took that work very, very seriously. If you can imagine thinking that a fire was just completely going to destroy the environment. It was very hard work, but they were very effective.
Yeah, I mean, I've talked to older guys who grew up in the 50s and 60s, and they remember, one guy is in the 60s. He's on his way to New Paltz to go out for the evening, probably the bars. He's a teenager, 18 years old, 19. And he sees in front of him a forest ranger standing in the road, and he knows exactly what it is because it's happened to him before, he said. And the forest ranger would enlist people right on the spot. And you would be forced.
You'd be
pressed into fighting fire.
Or something like that.
And there was one fire he fought in Peekamoose area. There was a fire over there in West Shokan, and he had to fight that one. So this one he knew, and he turned around and went the other way because, he had stuff to do, man.
Yeah.
But
you want to be conscripted.
Right, you want to be conscripted. That's the word I'm looking for. So...
But yeah, it's interesting. I mean, fighting fires is still the U.S. Forest Service's primary role. I mean, most of their funding, most of their time and expense goes to fighting fires.
It made them famous. It made them extremely relevant, the Forest Service. And you go online now, and Smokey the Bear, you can find a lot of trinkets and stuff with Smokey memorabilia and whatnot.
Oh, yeah, still?
Oh, yeah. So... Even before, in the 30s, 40s, as though, there was a whole campaign, especially geared towards Southerners. They'd go into the southern United States. This is according to Stephen Pine, where they would convince them not to burn, because it's far more in their culture to burn in the South than it is up in the North, although people did burn in the North. But in the South, they'd burn the piney woods to remove ticks and unwanted vegetation. And in New York, up until the 1940s, some areas were burned, like above Ellenville on the Shangham Ridge. That area was burned quite a bit by berry pickers. Every 1 to 3 years, you got to burn again to get that low bush blueberry to grow.
Absolutely.
So
the more sunlight, for sure.
Yeah, a lot of people's ancestors probably burned in the West Shokan area, the escarpment area, the Catskills, where the Hudson River meets the Catskills. It's a great area to burn because, one, it's right at the edge of where a lot of people live in the Rondo Valley, the Hudson Valley. But also fire normally burns uphill away from you because, oxygen kind of feeds it from the bottom.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a really effective tool, especially for landscapes that evolved with fire. Basically it just resets succession, really. Clears up dead underbrush, diseased trees. By resetting the forest, you're also changing the species composition. So bringing in more light, you're bringing in more diverse species there as well.
Yeah.
So it's not, all fires aren't bad in that sense.
Well, this kind of came to a head, and I remember this in the 80s. Hearing about it, the Yellowstone fire. So this was kind of like a wake-up call that maybe Smokey Bear...
1910, I think it was.
It's not all bad. Well, this one was 1988.
Oh.
This is a big Yellowstone fire. And, what I was taught in forestry school is what we learned then was suppressing all fires can be a bad thing. It can actually backfire on you. And... fuels are building up over time, and instead of having frequent low-intensity fires, now you get one big fire, and it's just huge.
You get those crown fires. It's not just burning along the stem, with a thick bark tree that can recover from it. It's burning the whole crown of that tree.
Yeah. So that was kind of a wake-up call. Now, like you said, fire can be great to get shade-intolerant vegetation. Oak, hickory, chestnut when it was around. There's just some trees that when you burn frequently for a long period of time at the right time can outcompete other trees. So kind of like maple, they can outcompete those. We've talked about that before on the show quite a bit. But Smokey the Bear, despite fire's importance and significance in forest ecology and having a place, it lives on. I mean, I still hear public service announcements, and that's the message that is resonating, is that fires are bad, no matter what. Fires are terrible. How did this start? According to Stephen Pine, I remember him saying, is in part it was the timber industry. I mean, they wanted to protect their asset. Overreaching government in the 1930s looking to put people to work. There was a lot of not just fire suppression and putting people to work, but, you know, the New Deal had people planting trees everywhere in fields, you know, these spruce trees that we have to live with. Post-World War II, looking to put machines to work, got all this military surplus equipment. Or, you know, in part, is probably a well-intentioned policy that simply got away. You know, I believe that. I don't think it was done maliciously for the most part.
No, it was responding to a perceived kind of necessity. But it was informed by knowledge that it's just not relevant anymore.
Yeah. So, you know, other states have kind of woken up to this. If you go to Kentucky, they'll write you a burn plan. A friend of mine who used to be the former president of the Quality Deer Management Association in New York State, he moved to Kentucky, and he's a big deer hunter, likes to manage wildlife habitat, and when he said that, a forester from the state of Kentucky came over and wrote him a burn plan. That's amazing. Fire is extremely rare to practice in New York State from what I've observed. Have you ever seen a prescribed burn in New York yet?
Not in person, no.
Yeah.
But, I imagine it's a coordinated operation, and people are working together to try and move fire in certain places. They have to do it under the right conditions, right? And I think they, it can be controlled and used on landscape as a tool.
Yeah, I was really ecstatic about it. I came back from school probably around 2004, somewhere in there, and I saw that they were doing a prescribed burn on the Shangam Ridge over Mohonk Preserve. And I was like, I'm going to go check it out, you know. And they want to burn there because they're losing their biodiversity. You know, like pitch pine, chestnut oak, blueberry. A lot of these things are going away because they're being outcompeted by more shade-tolerant plants like maple trees. And in order to preserve that component, they need to burn. So here they are. They're getting ready to do a burn. And I drive over there, and I kid you not, there must have been a half a dozen agencies there, at least, maybe more. There was forest rangers. There was Office of Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation. I think even the city of New York was there for some reason, DEP. The DEC was there. I don't know. There's a number of others. The amount of people that were involved just told me, oh, I don't think this will ever happen on private land. I mean, it was a private preserve, so, you know, they can maybe access resources in a different way, but, you know, it was just way too overblown, I thought, to be a sustainable practice that could happen in a real practical way after seeing that.
Yeah, it's a lot of people's time and schedules. To try and do that on somebody's private property, I imagine they'd have to go through a lot of red tape.
Yeah.
Especially, with neighbors and safety concerns, stuff like that.
So there was a nod in 2001. They did change the slogan, the Forest Service, from only you can prevent wildfires. Only you can prevent forest fires to only you can prevent wildfires. Try to, you know, instill maybe in people that, okay, well, if it's a wildfire, you know, maybe we'll let it go because it's natural. Mm-hmm. The thing is, this is a big misconception. In the eastern United States, we don't get natural fires. I can't really speak for Western United States because I don't live there. But in Eastern United States, where we get greater than 40 inches of precipitation, it's extremely rare. And this has been studied. I mean, Mohonk Mountain House has been studying fires on the ridge for over 100 years. And from what I remember when I read the data, I think there was only one out of 100 that were, maybe they thought was natural and they weren't sure, from lightning, because we get rain. So almost all of them are human-caused, whether on purpose or accidental, in Eastern United States. So the impacts of the message of fire suppression. And like I've already kind of said before, it's been huge on these preserves. I mean, when I first went to Sam's Point Preserve, which was formerly owned by the Nature Conservancy on the Shangham Ridge, Central Ulster County, it was considered, in quotes, one of the last great places by the Nature Conservancy. Hmm. And it was because it's got so much diversity. You know, there's so many different plants up there. You basically have every tree species except for balsam fir, I would say. You got red spruce all the way to pitch pine, chestnut oak, bear oak, sassafras. It's pretty cool. And a lot of them are pyrogenic, meaning they rely upon fire to outcompete more shade-tolerant plants. So because fire hasn't been happening up there, there's a lot of now, well, the sassafras starting to grow in, and red maple. And really those low bush blueberry-like fields that used to be up there in the 80s and before are kind of growing in. You know, there's far less.
And they're growing, but without that light, you just won't see as many as that fruit, as many fruit, as many berries, and yeah.
I talked to an old guy at the Blueberry Festival in Ellenville maybe 10 years ago. He had a little diorama he set up with his blueberry cabin or shanty back in the 40s. These people they'd live up there in the summer and pick blueberries the whole summer. So he had a diorama of his shack up there. It was pretty cool. But he said back then, when they were burning and stuff, you'd pick like 86 quarts of blueberries, low bush, in a day. And, you know, I've picked blueberries on the mountain, and it's really hard to get 5 quarts. I mean, if you after a fire, you can do it because these blueberry heads will grow.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen that after there was an accidental fire in Minnewaska a few years back, and when you go back to those areas, the low bush blueberry is spotty before a fire, but then after a fire, it gets these literal heads of blueberries, and you just stick a rake in there, and bam, you're in business. And then you put them on a ramp so that they grow, they go a little faster than the leaves and wheat and other debris.
Oh, I see.
And you filter them that way. You put them on a little ramp.
Nice. Yeah, they'll just roll right down.
Oh, it's look, there's nothing better than wild low bush blueberry. They're the tastiest thing ever. There's so much taste in them. It's unreal.
Hmm.
But I missed that. Anyway, there was an accidental fire a number of years ago, also on Cherrytown Mountain. And that's when I realized just how awesome fire is. I mean, the amount of American chestnuts came up from these old roots.
Hmm.
Even though American chestnut dies from the chestnut blight, the roots are still there. And if there's a fire, they'll get, like, activated, right?
Wow.
And because they were from old roots, they produced American chestnuts.
Hmm.
And I was picking garbage bags of these things. And they are amazing. I mean, bears were taking them, you know, breaking them over to get to them. Blueberries were just growing in like crazy. Oak and hickory were sprouting from roots as well. There was just so much wildlife in there. So many ground nesting songbirds. It was loud in a good way. It was really different than what I experienced as a forest ranger in a Slide Mountain wilderness area where it's mature forest, and you'd hear some stuff in the summer like Bicknell's thrush and whatnot, veery, and white-throated sparrow. But then come August, it was like dead, you know, and you wouldn't see any wildlife. And if you saw a bear or a deer, or especially a deer, it was a big deal. But it was awesome to see that after a fire, the amount of plant response, and then the fauna that responds to that flush of flora. You know, it's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a lot of food that comes up. But, yeah, it must have been something.
So, there's no fire. And a lot of those are going away. And it's due to fire suppression. I mean, It's like we had, I think it was a lady from Auburn. But anyway, she says, you know, there's no questioning that after 1930s, when this fire suppression starts, 1940s, we start seeing a lot of these oak, hickory, chestnut, fire-dependent species start going down, and maple trees start going up in a big way. But in any case, that's our first message, is that only you can prevent forest fires, and as well-intentioned as this message was, I think it's severely flawed. And it's an old message. I mean, it's been around since 1944. And I think it's one of the most misconceived messages in the forest, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically led people to conclude that if we did nothing to prevent these fires, that we would lose the forest. And as you said, it kind of backfired in a different way. We lost the forest in the sense of we lost diversity to the forest. We lost resiliency to those systems.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was when that Minnewaska fire happened a few years back, it was such a lost opportunity for education, you know? There could have been some interpretation done by the state. But instead, they put that police tape around it. And it just it made it look like a crime scene. And I was like, man, people are going to get the wrong idea about that, you know?
Like it wasn't supposed to happen.
Yeah. Pretty cool to see, though, if you went up there after the fire. If you just kicked the dirt, the soil, that organic layer, it wasn't even burned underneath really that much. It's amazing. And the amount that just started growing shortly after that is pretty cool to see. Now, you can't just burn once and get, like, desired vegetation of oak, hickory, and chestnut. I mean, the red maple came in pretty fierce afterwards. But in some areas where there was crown fires, this is over on 4455, and you look over at the Catskills and the Rondout Valley. If you look to your left up the mountain, that burned really hot. And the only trees that are alive in the overstory are pitch pine. That is the most fire-resistant tree there is. And that is such a weird evergreen. I mean, such a weird pine. It actually flushes these water sprouts almost along the bark.
Yeah, it looks like a little kind of leaf budded out like around the base of the tree. It's really weird. Yeah, they're fire-adapted.
Yeah.
Have a lot of pitch, and I think it's one of those cones that don't really open up to release the seeds unless it's kind of heated to...
Serotonous.
Yeah, serotonous cones. Heated to a high degree.
You ever see a dwarf pitch pine? I mean, they don't grow more than 6 feet tall, and they can be from the late 1800s.
Huh.
Tough tree. Pretty cool. They're up on the ridge. Some of the oldest trees, you would never know. You walk right by them and think they can't be that old. No, they're old. Some of those have been cored, and they date back to the late 1800s, some of them.
Huh?
But it's pretty neat. So, let's take a break. And the second message we're going to talk about is climate change and projected maple decline. We'll be right back. All right, Zane. What movie was that in? Come on.
Jeez, on the spot. I am not sure.
I just watched it last night. Real Science.
Oh, okay.
Val Kilmer, man. Where, you know, they blow the house up with popcorn at the end. It's a classic.
No.
Come on.
I don't think I've seen
it. It gets confused with Weird Science. It's not Weird Science.
I know that.
Real Science.
I know that.
Yeah, I don't like Weird Science, but I like Real Science. It's a good movie, you know? Anyway.
We're talking about Real Science.
Well, yeah, we're talking about Real Science right now.
Weird Science.
Yeah, something like that. So the first message that we, I don't know, feel like needs to be reined in was the only you can prevent forest fires. Turns out there's another message now, but it's new and improved, and it's that we might be saying goodbye to maple trees.
Mm.
And one of our members, I don't know, he gave me some kind of thing that was produced by the USDA insinuating that we're going to lose our maple trees, our northern hardwoods, our maple trees and our beech trees. And I was like, you know, and he's asking whether he should plant southern species.
Mm.
This is highly concerning to me. I mean, I'm going to go home tonight and collect some maple sap. I love maple syrup. My second child is named Maple. So, you know, as much as I talk about oak and I love oak trees, I also like maple as well. So I don't want to lose those. So we fast forward to the early 2000s. And the second message is climate change and changing forests. Say goodbye to maple, beech, and northern hardwoods? Question mark. Start planting southern species? So, full disclosure, I'm not saying climate change is not impacting our environment or that the earth is not warming. I'm only talking about it in relation to tree projections. That's it. The other stuff, I'm not a climatologist or anything like that, but man, I think we do know tree species in the Catskills a little bit, though. We have a lot of data. We have a lot of experience with members, forest owners, six counties of the Catskills. And the Catskills are, they're no slouch. They're pretty diverse. I'd say one of the more diverse areas in New York State. And the reason why is you can be down where Zane lives at 250 feet in Kingston, Ulster County, mm-hmm. on the Hudson River. And where you can be on, you can be in Arkville at 1,400 feet in elevation. You can be in Claryville at 2,100 feet in elevation. You can be in Tannersville at a hair over 2,000 feet. Or you can be in Stanford, right? Yeah, it's just as high there. You can be on a north-facing slope, a south-facing slope, east, west-facing.
Yeah, are all microclimates.
Absolutely. So we get to see a lot of different habitats, soil types, and everything in between, and a lot of land use history, things that have occurred there, things that we know occurred there, things that sometimes we don't know occurred there. Sometimes what's cool about the Catskills is there is no record of humans being in the area. That's abnormal in the rest of the state. There are certain areas that we know were never settled.
Hmm.
If you go above a certain stream on the East Branch Neversink, it's first growth, meaning it was never touched by human beings. So that's in my mind as well. So anyway, are we going to lose them? Are we going to lose them to climate change? I don't know. What do you think, Zane?
Well, yeah, I mean, the assessment you're talking about, it sort of assess the effects of climate change in the Mid-Atlantic forest region ecosystems. So it uses modeling to kind of project what current trends in temperature and precipitation are for the next the end of this century, and how that changes kind of the species composition. So it predicts kind of range shifts in a lot of these species, and we're going to see less of these species that prefer conditions that are cool and moist, and more of these species that can tolerate drought and hot conditions, things like oaks, hickories, southern species. We're going to see less of these kind of northern hardwood species like maples, yellow birch, hemlocks, and they're either going to shift more northerly where they can establish easier.
Yeah. And this is a message. Now, we're going to talk about their caveat, because if you read more into this, they do have a big caveat. But, you know, I remember going to a conference, the Catskill Institute for the Environment, a few years back, up at Bel Air Mountain. And there was a speaker from the Cary Institute of Ecosystem Studies in Millbrook, Dutchess County. And they do a lot of research. And their executive director, I think it was him, he gets up there and he's talking about climate change and impacts. And, you know, I have no reason to believe or not to believe anything he's saying. You know, I believe it. Until he gets to the trees, and then my ears perk up, and I remember him saying it clear as day. He's like, there's going to be more oak and hickory in the Catskill Mountains, and there's going to be less maple and beech trees. And another guy and I look at each other like, what is going on? I mean, one, there's no regeneration in those species. They're not represented in the young age classes at all, meaning oak and hickory. They're just not regenerating. Or they're not regenerating nearly as much as the northern hardwoods are.
Mm-hmm.
Because northern hardwoods are mostly shade tolerant, so they can grow in undisturbed areas. The Catskills is mostly undisturbed because we don't have a lot of cutting going on and fires, so that kind of promotes maple trees and beech. You know, unless the deer get involved, but the deer are impacting oak as well, right? So anyway, oak needs a lot of sunlight. We're not seeing any oak. If anything, most of our job, we're at the Catskill Forest Association, is releasing oak trees from competing maple. So we do about 300 and plus consultations around the Catskills. Last year we did about 380 consultations around the Catskill Mountains. And a common thing that you might find, a typical forest setting, is they have an overstory of maybe red oak, if they're lucky, white oak. And competing with those and growing underneath are the more shade-tolerant red maple and sugar maple, and sometimes white ash, that are out-competing that overstory now. The reason why that is because when the farm was abandoned maybe 80 to 120 years ago, the oak and the sometimes white pine grow into that area, right? Mm. And then as nothing occurs for a while, then only trees that can grow under the shade of other trees start to regenerate. And that's your maple, ash, beech, stuff like that, sometimes yellow birch. This is very typical. So if anything, we need to release these oak trees if we want to preserve acorns. That's what we're usually after. If they're managing for wildlife, we got to preserve acorns. We got to release oak trees.
Yeah, we can't take them for granted. We can't take it for granted that they'll be established in these areas in the future. Because, you know, we're seeing more maple, red maple than ever. A lot of these species are very persistent, and, we just don't see anything regenerating.
I just feel like people have the blinders on when it comes to this. They're like, well, temperature's rising, that means we're going to get southern tree species. That's not that simple. And, you know, if we rewind, I remember reading this whole symposium that was done in the Ozarks of Arkansas, and even they were losing some of their oak trees to these mesic hardwoods, these more northern hardwoods, central hardwoods rather, or northern hardwoods that are more shade tolerant. If you go to New Jersey, you go to the Hudson River Valley, you go to Dutchess County, you know, an area where humans have been a lot more than in places in the Catskills. Typical thing you might find is black locust, shade intolerant, started to pioneer the old abandoned farm field, some oak. And there's just beautiful sugar maple just growing underneath all those trees in Dutchess County. I typically see that. I don't think the forest inventory analysis, which the USDA does every year or so or whatever in each county across the United States, I don't think it indicates that we're seeing any more oak and hickory growing in the Northeast. I think if you were to inventory foresters' tally sheets in New York State, it would not indicate that. New York State's most common and abundant tree is the red maple, seconded by sugar maple. Mm-hmm. American beech is up there in the Catskills. It might even be our number one tree species. Not seeing it.
Yeah, I believe it. I think a lot of our skepticism comes from the fact that, you know, climate change will not affect all forests the same way. It won't affect the same species, communities, parts of the landscape the same way. But the idea that the Catskills is more vulnerable to climate change is something we're kind of skeptical of, because these local factors that we've been talking about, like land use history, microclimates, these have a bigger influence at the site than these kind of general trends. So it's not always guaranteed that these massive rain shifts will happen because of all these kind of local conditions. And that's what the assessment doesn't really factor in, which is hard. It's hard to study these things and make sense of them, but these larger general trends are just that. They're general, and they don't take account into these local factors.
Yeah, I guess what we're saying is perhaps, yeah, climate change matters, but culture matters more. And the land use history that's been going on there for hundreds of years, thousands of years, humans have been involved in the forest a long time, or when they're not involved, what that does as well. So, I mean, we've had Mark Abrams on the radio show from Penn State University. He uses this term called mesification, and I guess there was someone else listening to this show, and they didn't understand that when I said this. So mesification is just basically disturbance-intolerant plants or shade-tolerant plants that take over an area. So if humans aren't cutting or if they're not burning, that tends to favor trees that are really shade-tolerant, right? They don't thrive, and they don't get they start to outcompete other trees when there's no disturbance. This would be maple, beech.
Yeah, the way I think about it is, I might be wrong, we'll see what you think, but these are kind of generalist species. These species kind of prefer kind of a middle range of conditions. And since there's no management done to kind of create less homogeneous forests, we see less species that can occupy the edges of these conditions. More drought-tolerant species like oaks and hickories. Species that are adapted to kind of more poorly drained areas, where you see a lot more of these generalist species.
Yeah, red maple is definitely a generalist because it can tolerate both wet and dry sites, whereas sugar maple kind of needs well-drained, good soils. In the forest preserve, I feel like it's going towards black birch. It's a shade-tolerant tree, and the deer don't browse it.
That's something I see every day. As soon as a tree is dropped or fallen over or dies for whatever reason, you see black birch come right up.
Yeah.
It comes up very quickly, very densely. That's what I see. That's what I observe all the time.
I'm not seeing oak and hickory growing in those areas anywhere, but I am seeing black birch. And, despite tasting like wintergreen, the twigs, the deer don't eat it. I like to chew on them, but the deer don't. So go figure, right? Isn't that weird? But so we're not seeing the oak and hickory regeneration. And, it does say as a caveat that culture, and local conditions matter, but it's kind of written in small print.
And it's kind of on the back end of the assessment.
Yeah.
And it should be on the front end.
I think so.
And it's not insignificant. I mean, talk about culture, we're talking about human choices. Human choices have a huge impact on how we manage our forests. And that's what Smokey the Bear has taught us, is if we stop, if we choose not to do something, that doesn't mean that the forest always benefits, that things don't always just stay the same.
So I think with more fire suppression, which is a cultural land use thing we're doing right now, fires are being suppressed, we're not lighting fires. And, with our 40 inches of rain, I think there's going to be fewer fires. It's going to promote more northern hardwoods. And it's like we had Dr. Heather Alexander from Auburn. Remember she talked about how rain differs when it hits a maple tree compared to an oak tree? I thought that was fascinating. A maple tree, because of its bark, the water will just, you'll have stem flow, and it'll just go right down the trunk of the tree. And because the tree leaves of a maple tree have less lignin, they also rot faster and soak in more moisture, so it creates damper litter, more damp, moister litter underneath a maple tree. They've done studies on this. So it's harder to burn just by its natural mechanics of the tree.
Yeah, it's basically engineering the site to be less fire prone.
That's cool.
And that is something that those species do. So that's just another reason that we think that any type of oak that's going to fall in there, they're just not going to establish.
Yep. And in the oak trees, they studied the litter underneath oak. And the bark will tend to absorb more moisture so that that moisture doesn't have stem flow and doesn't hit the ground as much. Also, the leaves of an oak, and you know this by walking in the woods, you slip on your butt, it's usually oak leaves. And it's because they have higher lignin, they curl. And a lot of people think they do that because maybe they're trying to promote drier conditions to get a ground fire, which again, if you get fires, that'll outcompete maple trees, right? Because tap roots and stuff, that oaks have more vigorous root systems than maple trees and beech. So it's kind of like they're trying to promote a drier landscape. So we're not seeing the oak as much. We're getting more maple, and I think we're going to have a harder time lighting fires in the future. It's going to be kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, but it's being driven, I would say, yeah, a little bit by climate change, but more so by cultural changes.
Yeah.
You know, human beings just aren't involved in the woods as much as they used to. That's a recent phenomenon. You know, there's tons of evidence out there that humans have probably burned for a long time.
Yeah, indigenous peoples, I mean, those part of their culture, part of their tradition was burning the landscape. So that's the only way to get those big blueberries, those chestnuts.
Yeah, and I could be wrong on this, but I remember Mark Abrams saying that he found when he looked at the data going back 1,000 years or whatever, even during cooler periods, they still had oak and hickory increasing. And I remember he equated that to, it wasn't that the cooling temperatures were good for oak, it was just that the humans were burning so much it didn't matter. Yeah. Proving the point that maybe culture mattered more is what he's saying. I agree. I think culture still matters, despite maybe a warming climate, because we're not burning, because we're suppressing everything, because there's less disturbance in the forest. We're going to have more maples despite a warming climate. So that's what I'm saying. Let's see. Let's take one more break here. And if you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest. Tonight's topic is Smokey the Bear, Climate Change, and Projected Maple Decline.
Yeah.
All right. That is Electric Light Orchestra. Can't get it out of my head. And what I can't get out of my head is these two messages being repeated in the forest, some since 1944 and some more recently. And we've been talking about on From the Forest tonight, Smokey Bear, and the message of only you can prevent forest fires and some of the flaws in that. And the second message is climate change and projected maple decline that's now being touted by the USDA Forest Service. And I think it's well-intentioned, but I think we've been saying that culture matters more on the tree species that you see or you do not see in the forest. We believe that the media is underemphasizing local conditions, an example, forest land use history, present condition, forest management, in their messaging. The impacts of poor messaging are wasted money, time, labor, opportunity costs. Our energy used towards planting southern species could have been used towards forest practices. I did reach out to the USDA, Northern Institute of Applied Climate Science, and their representative did agree about the local conditions outweighing climate change. The problem is it's at the back end of that assessment. That's the problem I have with it. You know, that's not what people are seeing right up front. So the two main problems of the above messages are, number one, the premise that northern hardwoods will decrease and southern hardwoods will increase is extremely inaccurate. Number two, about climate, which I guess is based from temperature, is a far second to cultural impacts that have occurred in the last 300-plus years and will continue to occur in the next 300, I would imagine. How humans have farmed, has far more reaching influences on the trees you see or not see than these climate projections. And that's why we always stress good forest management and cutting the right trees, usually. What do you think, Zane?
So, yeah, I think you're touching on a lot of points, but the assessment considered just how vulnerable our forests are in the Mid-Atlantic. Their susceptibility to changing in the next 100 years, and the reasons why. But yeah, as you said, I think at this local level, human choices have the biggest short term impact. What we choose to do and choose not to do.
Yeah, there's interfering species, you know, or invasive species brought over that impacts for sure. You know. But I don't know about rising temperatures in the short term. I don't know. I guess we'll see.
Yeah, time will tell. Local characteristics for sure.
Well, that's all we got on tonight's show. And if you missed it, it was Smokey Bear, climate change, and projected maple decline. Next week, we're going to talk about sugaring. Got to talk about backyard maple sugaring, maybe.
Yeah?
Yeah. It's time. It's been a while. Usually we talk about deer or maple trees at some point, maple syrup, and people are probably tired of hearing us talk about it, but we haven't talked about maple syrup in a little while, so we might have to do it again.
Not yet this year.
Not this year. So, all right. Have a good night.
Good night, everyone.
Oh, the neon lights were flashing and the icy wind did blow. The water seeped into his shoes and the drizzle turned to snow. His eyes were red, his hopes were dead, and the wine was running low. And the old man came home from the forest. His tears fell on the sidewalk as he stumbled in the street. A dozen faces stopped to stare, but no one stopped to speak. For his castle was a hallway, and the bottle was his friend. And the old man stumbled in from the forest. Up a dark and dingy staircase, the old man made his way. His ragged coat around him as upon his cot he lay. And he wondered how it happened
vision did appear. Upon his mantle shining the face of one so dear, who'd loved him in the springtime of a long forgotten year. When the wildflowers did bloom in the forest, she touched his grizzled fingers and she called him by his name. And then he heard the joyful sound of children at their games in an old house on a hillside in some forgotten town, where the river runs down from the forest.
WIOX is supported by the generosity of our listeners and the following underwriters. The Delaware County Chamber of Commerce, a catalyst for sustainable economic prosperity in the Catskills, fostering cooperation, forging partnerships, promoting tourism, providing legislative advocacy, and building strong community ties throughout the region. More information at 607-746-2281 or delawarecounty.org. Rick's Tire Service, family-owned and operated on State Route 30 between Roxbury and Grand Gorge. Tires, mounting, and wheel balancing for cars, trucks, lawn, garden, farm, and construction vehicles. Open Monday through Friday, 8 to 5. Saturday, 8 till noon. More information at